Indianapolis and 106.7 FM in St. Paul. Streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Paul Van Dyke.
I'm Jesse Hausman. Tonight on Right on Radio, Paul speaks with poet and essayist Heidi Sirwick about her recently released poetry collection, Conjoining. She is also the author of the forthcoming lyric essay collection, Fluid States. Winner of the, I'm not sure if I know how to say
Pleiades.
It. Pleiades. Thank you. Press 2018 Robert C. Jones Prize for Short Prose, and is the editor of North Dakota Is Everywhere, an anthology of contemporary North Dakota poets. She lives in Minneapolis, where she is senior poetry editor with Poetry City USA and mentors with the Minnesota Prison Writing Workshop.
And I'm Josh Weber. Also, Connor speaks with Scott Hartley about the fuzzy and the techie, why the liberal arts will rule the digital world. He has served as a presidential innovation fellow at the White House and is a venture capitalist and startup advisor. He's a contributing author to the MIT Press book, Shopping for Good. He has also written for publications such as Inc., Foreign Policy, Forbes, and Boston Review.
Hey, Scott, you there?
Yep, I'm here.
All right, you can start at any minute.
Okay. Anthropologists in self-driving cars. Car maker Nissan has enlisted Melissa Chefkin, a PhD anthropologist from Rice University, to evaluate its design and lead company research into human-machine interaction at the Nissan Technical Center. Currently, she leads a team investigating the complexities of the ways in which self-driving cars and humans will likely interact and what the implications of those complexities are for how the car should be designed and controlled. To consider why her input is necessary, let's take a look at the prospects and the potential pitfalls of self-driving vehicles. The engineering feat of getting this technology deployed has been a stunning accomplishment, but many thorny questions remain to be answered about safety. In 2016, the tragic death of a Tesla driver, car equipped with autonomous navigation autopilot technology, highlighted the current limitations automotive designers face when accounting for all dangers. His death occurred in the least complex driving environment, the open highway. When autopilot failed to detect a tractor trailer was switching lanes, moving to the front of the Tesla. Analysis later revealed that the truck's white body had eclipsed against the bright spring sky. The driver may have failed to spot the truck because he had pulled up his face in autopilot, taking his eyes off the road to watch a Harry Potter movie. Experts agree that, as yet, you know, many situations that autonomous vehicles might encounter on roads are beyond their ability to safely navigate, such as flooded roads, large potholes, road debris, and temporary traffic controls, for example, detour signs. Now, Chefkin is studying the challenges of self-driving cars navigating within our even more crowded and inherently unpredictable, non-routine, and complex urban environments. Dealing with mixed human and machine environments is one of the most difficult challenges facing autonomous car drivers today and designers. Ultimately, these environments will be homogeneously machine operated, but for this foreseeable future, these environments will be pluralistic, where machines could be programmed to be efficient and rule abiding. Humans are messy rule breakers who analyze situations on a case by case basis using complex sets of interpretations that are hard to teach to a machine. Take a busy intersection with stop signs but no stoplights. Cars proceed in a way that is determined less by rules than by the subtle choreography on the go. A hand wave here, a rude gesture there, some inching forward by the especially eager motorists. Anthropologist Edward Sapir wrote about the nuanced human communication system of gestures, which is, quote, an elaborate and secret code that is written nowhere, known by none, and understood by all. An autonomous vehicle can't yet perceive all the gestures or understand these moves. The machine knows only to stop at the sign. It's up to Chefkin to figure out what it should do from there and how it should manage the complex dance that is human interaction.
All right. Well, we're speaking with Scott Hartley, author of The Fuzzy and the Techie, Why the Liberal Arts Will Rule the Digital World. He has served as presidential innovation fellow at the White House and is a venture capitalist and startup advisor. He is contributing author of the MIT Press book, Shopping for Good. He has also written for publications such as Inc., Foreign Policies, Forbes, and Boston Review. So, I guess, can you give us a quick idea of which how you just read relates with the Fuzzy and the Techie?
Yeah, first of all, thank you so much for having me. It's wonderful to be with you.
Hey, thank you.
So the Fuzzy and the Techie, you know, the concepts, they come from a set of terms that go back to the 1970s, actually to Stanford University in Northern California, you know, sort of at the heart of, in the epicenter of Silicon Valley. And the terms are just sort of lighthearted associations or monikers to kind of refer to, you know, somebody who studies the humanities or the social sciences being a fuzzy, and somebody who studies the engineering or computer sciences being a techie, and really, you know, about the false division between these two halves. You know, I think if we go back to, you know, 1959 and Charles Percy Snow, who was both a physicist and a novelist in Britain, he delivered a famous lecture at Cambridge University where he lamented these two cultures, kind of the fragmentation between the sciences and the humanities and how we had to bring the two sides together. And I think, you know, fast forwarding to today, almost 60 years later from when C.P. Snow delivered that famous two cultures lecture at Cambridge, we have this the same sort of false dichotomy, the same false divide between, you know, when we talk about technology and robotics and automation, and then we have sort of a secondary conversation about ethics, or we think about artificial intelligence, but then secondarily we think about what is this doing to us, you know, as people. And I think that this this story about Melissa Chivkin and her being, you know, a PhD anthropologist who's working in the self-driving car unit of Nissan, I think highlights the issue that, you know, while we focus so much on science, technology, engineering, and math, and we think so heavily about our future being technological, in many ways, you know, the biggest challenges are anthropological, they're sociological, you know, they're philosophical and thinking about the ethical implications of some of these technologies. And I think that if you look beneath the hood of a lot of these companies, some of the key hires and some of the skill sets that are most valued are actually some of these softer skill sets, which, you know, we kind of lightheartedly at Stanford refer to as fuzzy qualities. So that's sort of how it ties back to the theme of the book.
Now, has that always been the case that the tech companies try to have a good mixture of the two, the fuzzy and the techie, or the liberal arts and the STEM degree?
You know, I think it's a good question. If you go back to the 1990s, I do think there was more technological infrastructure in some ways that was being laid, the foundational building blocks of Silicon Valley, you know, being semiconductors and processing power and some of the basic infrastructure. Whereas today, you know, many of the startups and many of the technologies that we see, they are at the what I would call the application layer, where it's taking the technological building blocks and it's applying it to the world around us. And I think one of the things that we overlook with, you know, these sort of soft skills and study of humanities and social sciences is that these are study of the basic human condition, you know, so not just how the world works, but actually our place within the world. And I think that as we think about contextualizing technology, as we think about taking technology and applying it to the biggest problems that we face as societies, you know, as people, a lot of the insights that are how we put this technology to use, the insights come from, you know, a deeper context and a deeper study of human nature. So I think that, you know, it has changed, but certainly today, you know, the impetus for my writing the book was actually both my own experience as somebody who studied political theory, political science, international relations, yet, you know, grew up kind of working at companies like Google and Facebook and in venture capital, where I interacted with hundreds of different startup founders. And in that second capacity, it was looking around at many of the most interesting companies being founded and having this observation that the comparative advantage, the thing that really gave some of those companies their secret sauce, wasn't the technology. It was actually the application of technology to a big problem. So it was somebody who had studied sociology, they'd studied psychology, they thought about user behavior, they thought about what was going to nudge somebody to do something in the app that was going to lead them to come back more and more. You know, and I think that if we look at the major insights between, you know, within consumer apps like Facebook or Instagram or Snapchat, the real things that drive user behavior that get, you know, kind of get us coming back for more, these are, you know, behavioral characteristics. These are psychological aspects of the apps that I think we often overlook as just being coded into ones and zeros, and it's all about the code, when in fact, you know, the driving rationale behind why lots of people use these products on a daily basis has much more to do with psychology and design than it does purely about the code. So that's sort of the observation I had, and the reason that I wanted to write this book, kind of a counter-narrative about Silicon Valley being more than just code.
All right. Well, you know, Easter just happened, so all of us are getting back from seeing our family. So in hindsight, what would have been the best way for me to argue back at my uncle when he told me my liberal arts degree is a waste of money?
Well, you know, it depends how quickly you want to win that argument. I think one of the things that I observed in Silicon Valley was just the sheer number of incredible founders and CEOs and entrepreneurs who come from these backgrounds, and sort of, you know, pulling back the curtain on Silicon Valley, kind of looking beneath the hood and realizing that some of our favorite applications, for example, Instagram, was co-founded by a guy named Mike Krieger, who studied a mixture of philosophy and linguistics. LinkedIn, which we all probably use to add coworkers, was founded by Reid Hoffman, you know, who studied philosophy in graduate school. Or maybe at work, you use Slack as a communications platform, which was founded by Stuart Butterfield, who has 2 degrees in philosophy. Or, you know, maybe you just like watching YouTube, in which case, that company is run by Susan Wojcicki, who studied history and literature. Or maybe you like Pinterest, which was founded by a guy who studied political science. And so you kind of take a look around some of the keystone companies that we think of as being kind of uniformly and monolithically techie. And in fact, the senior leaders and oftentimes the product visionaries behind these companies have a much broader skill set than I think we give them credit. Even, you know, I think Mark Zuckerberg, who we could spend a lot of time talking about, given the recent challenges with Facebook and data and sort of the psychological hooks of luring people back into this sort of attention economy. But even Mark Zuckerberg, who we think of as uniformly technical, he actually studied, you know, he studied psychology at Harvard. He came from a classic liberal arts background at Exeter prior to that, where he, you know, really studied holistically and sort of pulled on his curiosity to have passion to learn things like Chinese today. And I think that, you know, we think about some of these characters as uniformly technical. And I think that that, you know, doesn't do justice to the sort of full suite of skills that we learn in a broad-based liberal arts program, you know, where we are taught the soft skills. We're taught to think holistically, to develop passions and curiosities, and, you know, learn to collaborate with others. And one of the most interesting, I think, counterintuitive points that I try to make in the book is that in this world of increasing technology, in this world of increasing robotics, and we have this fear of automation, you know, and much of that is valid because all of us have jobs with some component of tasks that are routine, that are scripted, that are repeatable, that we do over and over and over. And over time, those are things that if they're manual, you know, we can probably do them better with robotics. If they're cognitive, we can probably do them better with machine learning. But what that really does is it frees us up to be more human. And I think the very skills that we learn in programs, broad-based liberal arts type programs, where we're learning to collaborate together, we're learning to communicate, we're developing empathy to see problems from somebody else's eyes. These are the very skills that actually differentiate us from machines.
All right. Well, how about we have you do that second reading right about now, and then we'll continue with some more questions.
All right. So on that last point, machines can't intuit, create, or feel. A whole set of human abilities still haven't been approximated by artificial intelligence. For example, machines are still incapable of true idea generation. Russian programmers behind the Prisma app have figured out how to use neural networks to turn your latest photograph into a work of art in the style of Van Gogh or Picasso, which is certainly impressive and loads of fun. But there's no originality involved in doing so. Walk slowly with a student of contemporary art history through the Andy Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh, stand in front of Picasso's Guernica at Madrid's Reina Sofia Museum or drag your fingers over the cold, undulating steel of Richard Serra to know art. Machines are also incapable of anything resembling human emotion and therefore utterly lack empathy. Google can feed its AI engine 2,865 romance novels in order to make it more fluent in emotional language and situations, but will it really make it more empathetic, capable of understanding love or desire? Will our machines laugh with Jane Austen or feel the pathos of Tolstoy? These are just two key characteristics of the mysterious phenomenon known as human consciousness, which even today's smartest machines don't possess. Anyone who saw the movie The Imitation Game, about how Alan Turing, the inventor of the computer age, cracked the Germans' Enigma code during World War II, can recall that the context and human intuition played a central role in the machine's success. And more than four decades ago, Hubert Dreyfus, a philosopher at UC Berkeley, outlined the conceptual limits of artificial intelligence in his 1972 book, What Computers Can't Do. Those limits revolve around the difference between computation, which machines do very well, and consciousness, which machines don't possess. Many in the high-tech community ignored or mocked Dreyfus's arguments at the time. But even today, the debate continues. In 2011, along with Harvard philosophy chair Sean Dorrance Kelly, Dreyfus said, quote, "The greatest danger is not that it proves machines could be better versions of us, but that it tempts us to misunderstand ourselves as poorer versions of them." Leading experts in AI today generally agree that the advent of more powerful machine learning algorithms and more capable natural language processing cannot yet approximate human intelligence and are still in, quote, the in vitro phase.
So
today, Fei-Fei Li is the director of artificial intelligence at Stanford and a proponent of going beyond data-driven deep learning, embracing the fuzzy emotional and social components of intelligence. Quote, "We humans are terrible at computing with huge data," she says, "but we're great at abstraction and creativity. We need diversity of thought and the curiosity to ask the right questions, two characteristics nurtured through the liberal arts. And we need people passionate in all disciplines to bring that expertise to bear on our newest tools. There ought to be anthropologists, sociologists, and psychologists in every cutting-edge AI lab." Quote, "Keep your own Iliad under your pillow," Harvard President Drew Faust advised the hundreds of cadets at her lecture at West Point in 2016. Quote, "Lead also on behalf of the liberal arts, of the traditions of human experience and humane insight that they represent. Recognize the importance of the attributes that they have given you. Mark their presence in your lives. Advocate for them in the lives of others. Be the world's force for the humanities and thus for human possibility," end quote. Technology's promise is great, but it requires our liberal arts in equal measure, the fuzzy and the techie, working together in pursuit of shared human goals.
All right. Well, I guess that's a good explanation of how being able to use things like the liberal arts can help bridge the gap between technology and how we want it to work for us. So for somebody who is from the Midwest, how can this help me? Since we're as far away from Silicon Valley as you can be, at least in a general sense, how is the liberal arts going to help somebody in a technological sense out here?
It's a great question. I think that the way we have to, you know, all sort of think about our education is in the engineering term of our education being in beta. So I think that this sort of one and done notion of receiving a degree that might be a degree in anthropology or a degree in computer science, we have this tendency to sort of debate what destination is most appropriate for the future, most appropriate for tomorrow. And we sort of have this debate between the merits of, you know, the equivalent is the merits of flying to Bogota or flying to Beijing. You know, the truth is they're vastly different places. They both have many amazing qualities to them, and they're both important in the future economy. I think that, you know, one of the things we have to start doing is thinking about education more holistically, where we try to fill out our skill sets with both technical kind of breaking the ice on technical feasibility, technical qualities that we can get better at and be not intimidated by, but also, you know, think about our education in terms of a passport where, you know, if we're technical, we owe it to ourselves to take a course in theater arts, to read Shakespeare, to think about public speaking and things that might intimidate us, and vice versa. You know, if we're somebody who loves English literature or, you know, a quote-unquote fuzzy subject, like we say at Stanford, this is something where, you know, we owe it to ourselves to challenge ourselves and learn about data science mm-hmm. or take an online coding class. So I think that these concepts don't matter so much what geography you're in, but matter more, you know, how we think about blending these two cultures, you know, going back to the conversation about C.P. Snow and his Two Cultures lecture in 1959, you know, bringing that to the current and thinking about not just fear of robots and automation, you know, not just fear, but kind of bring this pendulum back to this is really a hopeful time as well, where this technology will free us from many kind of rote and routine tasks, as long as we don't forget, you know, the very qualities that make us more human and more capable than those machines and those devices.
All right. Well, so you'll also be continuing on with the Midwest. You'll also be at Century College in White Bear Lake on April 12th. Can you give us an idea of how you hope to get your message across to the students at Century College?
Yeah, I'm very excited. I'll be speaking at the 50th anniversary symposium, sort of the intersection of technology and the liberal arts, and thinking about, you know, how, especially in today's world, as we've all, you know, come to grips with over the past weeks, months, and years, about sort of the influence that technology has on all parts of our lives. You know, how can we be thinking about asking the right questions, putting the right pressure, developing the right habits in how we deal with and think about technology, how we incorporate it into our lives, how we, you know, maybe want to participate as users of technology or want to participate as, you know, potential entrepreneurs in this sort of technology-led world. And the biggest insight that I have is that while STEM and technology is very important, so too are the human skills, so too are the behavioral soft skills, the psychology, the design, contextualizing our technology within our world. So the thing that I hope to get across to students and to anyone who comes to the event is basically that, you know, our technology needs diversity. It needs a pluralistic user base and types of people contributing, entrepreneurs. And so really it's more a message of hope that, you know, you should you can participate in this technology-led world, and that this technology world needs you regardless of your skill set, because we all have something to contribute.
All right. Well, so another thing that I guess I wonder. Okay. Well, I guess actually we've got to wrap this up. So, sorry about that. So The Fuzzy and the Techie is out in hardcover already and comes out in paperback this month. So Scott, thanks for calling in, and sorry we got to cut it off so quick.
It's great to be with you. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Bye. And now this.
Mutual Management is now accepting students in off-campus affordable housing on the West Bank and at the Blue Goose Co-op. Unfamiliar with cooperative living? Mutual Management Company can answer all your questions. Find community or build it by calling Mutual Management at 612-333-9164. 612-333-9164.
Conjoining. Several legends trace the appearance of the monster in the world to the moment of the collapse of the Tower of Babel. David Williams, Deformed Discourse. For weeks, we lay in separate beds but dreamed the same dreams. In our mother tongue, there is no word for it, unworded. What ecstasy it had been to be so wholly absorbed into another, sewn like together like lovers, hugging so hard we verged on merge. But the learned surgeon towered above us, found us tragic but fixable. When our sternum separated, in tears if either should die, our hearts had never beat so far apart. We who did not exist beyond embrace now exist excised, exorcised, a brace of bodies, the bridge abridged. Across the operating theater we awoke, double amputees, alone, unheld, our disunion terrible to behold. We had tried to warn you, but could only face each other, behold each other with a threatening countenance. The threat was you, you the deformity. Listen, we lost our link to language. Come together, we had built above Babylon's plains a tower, a tongue to tongue the word of God. Adumbrous, our tongues unable but to babble of what we witnessed next. Babel's tower reared up its splintered, minareted heads and fell, was felled. From each throat spilled forth monstrous forms, unspeakable. Gainst nature's lore some wonder forth doth spring. Split from heaven, our bodies mocked that broken bridge in stuttering conjunctions, and. We joined you, dwelt in possibility, female and male, most perfectly shaped, save joined breast to breast, doubly monstrous, not one, not two, terrible to behold. Our mother's tongue cried out a new language, born of horror. Our mother died as we choked her womb's throat. Our mother made money exposing us in freak shows, or left us exposed, or trusted the midwife to drop or disappear us. The local witch advised we be deprived of food 8 days, but we survived. Even today, we are grounds for termination. Even today may be severed without our mother's consent. Terminate. From Terminus, region ruled by Janus, two-faced God who would not forgive this division. What God has joined, let no man split asunder. Yet the surgeon cites God's love and his success to change one helpless form into two beautiful people. From this abrupt rupture, the hurt received in the separation, we ceased to be wondrous. Later, we, whose toddling walk was waltz, had to step into new gravities. Unpartnered in this unfamiliar dance, we fell. Each other's phantom limb, we haunted the halls, casting shadow selves who could rejoin at will. Now I am I. You are you. God is in his heaven.
That was Heidi Serwick, reading from her poetry collection, Conjoining. She is the editor of North Dakota is Everywhere, an anthology of North Dakota poets. She lives here in Minneapolis, where she works as the senior poetry editor for Poetry City USA and as a mentor for the Minnesota Prison Writers Workshop. Her forthcoming lyric essay collection, Fluid States, recently won Pleiades Press's 2018 Robert C. Jones Prize for Short Prose. Heidi, welcome to Write on Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about the poem you just read?
Sure. It's the title poem, Conjoining, from my collection. And it's an attempt to give voice to conjoined twins throughout history, both individually and as collective, from the very beginning of time all the way up till contemporary times.
And you worked in with the quote with the Tower of Babel. I thought you worked that in beautifully.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I thought that was a really weird detail that I had discovered, that supposedly when the Tower of Babel fell, that's where the origin of monsters into humanity originated.
Yeah. It gave me the idea, or it gave me the sense that that's when we became unfamiliar to each other.
Yeah, and yet weirdly conjoined together. So becoming both strange and wonderful, and the idea that the conjoined twin is somehow a monster, which I found very upsetting and awful to read about. The idea that, like, even today, without a mother or father's consent, that conjoined twins can be separated by surgeons because the assumption is that they're better off separated, as opposed to that they are a separate thing themselves, that they are not one, not two, but a creature unto themselves.
That's something I didn't know. I loved the entire poem is written in couplets, and then the last two are separated. And did that drive the entire because I got the sense of a couple being separated at the end.
Yeah, absolutely. The form of that. I'm a poet that for years and years wrote in traditional forms like sonnets and other received forms. While that's in free verse, it is in two-line stanzas and couplets. But most of the couplets are also not end-stopped, so they run on. So there's this play between what's coupled together and what's being separated throughout the whole poem.
Yeah, I've just been learning about form lately, and you have a poem in here called Doggerel, and I had to look up what a doggerel was, and I realized you had written a doggerel about a dog girl.
Right. Yeah.
I thought, throughout the whole collection, I thought you really had a wide range of form, and
right.
it just seemed like it was always really well executed.
Thank you very much.
Can you talk about the collection as a whole?
Sure. The collection originally started off with a failed collection of poems that I killed that was about dead bodies and how we react to them as a culture. So historically and medically and artistically, but it was a failed. The poems were boring and horrible. And not horrible because they were weird, but just horrible because they were badly written. But in the process of doing a lot of research about that, I had started also reading a lot about monstrous bodies. And so I was writing about the monstrous body and monstrosity and motherhood, which seemed monstrous to me as well. And around the same time, we adopted a child. And so I was also really preoccupied with that, about the idea of being the mother to a child that I was not growing inside me myself. So all of that came together in this souped up collection.
Yeah. There was a very long section of research notes.
Yes.
Can you talk about all the research? It sounds like you put in quite a bit of research.
I do, and that's a tendency that I have in most of my work. I don't like talking about myself, which I think for poetry...
You're in the wrong business if you're on this radio show.
Well, I think that people assume that poets write about their own feelings and their own experiences. And for me, I didn't really like talking about myself. So I do a lot of research and I tend to go down these long rabbit holes of research, finding these interesting facts. But there's a point that you have to come back out of the rabbit hole and have something more to say than just, here's this weird fact I found. So asking myself, you know, what makes this human, what makes this interesting, why is this important, is usually what leads to me writing about whatever it is, whether it's 50s pinup models or conjoined twins or perfume or whatever. So I do a lot of research for my writing.
I was just at a reading with two authors who are writing historical novels. And they were talking about the research, and one of them was of the school of, like, I'm just going to write what I write, and then I'm going to let the research fill in the details. And the other one was very, like, he did all of his homework, he got all the details, and then he sat down and wrote. Where do you fall with, like, the interplay between research and writing?
I think sort of in between, that I will start out doing a lot of research at the beginning. Once I start realizing, okay, I'm getting obsessed with a particular topic and I'm starting to look up a lot of stuff, I'll give myself a certain amount of time to do research, just because if I don't try to contain it somewhat, then I know I'll just keep following that rabbit hole, because it's really, really easy as a writer to pretend that you're writing when you're doing the research, because it's like, well, this is going to go into the writing, so it counts, right? But no, you have to put your butt in the seat and get down to the writing at some point. And so then I usually try to have gotten together all of my research and notes and sit down to write. But I will occasionally have to go back to try to fill in some of the texture or the background to give it details to flesh it out and make it feel more real as I write.
Yeah. Do you want to read another poem for us?
Sure. I think next I'll read from the sequence that's broken up throughout this collection, a sequence called A is for Ake, the Chinese Monster, and the Tragedy of P, his parasitic twin, which is a sequence about a real-life Cantonese man, what was then called Canton, port city that became Hong Kong, in China, when China first opened up to trade with the West. And there was a man, Ake, with a parasitic twin hanging from his chest, who was examined by Western doctors at one point in the 19th century when he was 18 years old. And that's all we know of him. And the rest of it I invented. And it takes place at the same time against the backdrop of the opium wars with Britain. And I'll read the first two. A is for Ake. At his birth, she felt her dying death like too many ships crowding the Crown's port at Canton. As she crowned, she felt her hull split in two. The last thing she saw looked like two singular things, a boy emerging and what looked like a boy emerging from that boy. A son to worship me, a son to be worshipped, she thought, and dying, died. The second one, B is for Brothers, is a form I tried to use throughout the entire sequence, but it didn't work out that well because they're really hard to write. Mm-hmm. A form that I've heard called a double exposure. I also heard called a contrapuntal, where you have two halves of a poem that are in two different voices and can be read separately. And then if you read them together, they create a third poem together. And because I had the conjoined twin, well, the parasitic twins in this, I have each half is spoken by each of the twins, and then together they form a conjoined poem. So I'll read the first half, then the second half, then the two together. B is for Brothers. This is the first half by Ake. He's the parasite, not me, the one the doctors labeled P. Inside my chest, he crowds my heart, until my rib cage spread apart. We grew, though he stayed runty, weak. The children leered and called us freak. Then this is P, the parasitic twin. Though precisely formed, I'm headless, as though I tried to climb inside him. Everything was dark. Then a decade where all I did was gawk. That stunted heart in front of me. I did not like what I could see. And then the two together. He's the parasite, not me. Though precisely formed, I'm the one the doctors labeled P. Headless, as though I tried to climb inside my chest. He crowds my heart inside him. Everything was dark until my rib cage spread apart. Then a decade where all I did was gawk. We grew, though he stayed runty, weak. That stunted heart in front of me. The children leered and called us freak. I did not like what I could see.
That was Heidi Serwick reading from her collection, Conjoining. So there was just the one statue of Ake. And what led you to write an entire alphabet? There's a few letters not in there, but an entire alphabet, essentially, of poems about him.
There were originally a whole alphabet, but not all the poems were good. So some of them I cut out. I was at the Harvard Medical School in the basement. They have a section that's the historical library, that's medical information that's no longer useful, that it's been outgrown, that it's no longer accurate. But they have a lot of interesting things down there. And I had gone there to do some research. And while I was researching, the curator, Dominic, came and set down that statue of Ake on my desk with this big thunk. And I thought it was really interesting and weird. And I read the account of it and figured I'd get a couple of poems out of it, and then ended up writing a whole sequence about it, which became a chapbook, and then kind of kept going with it.
You had mentioned that the poems are written over the backdrop of the Opium War.
Right.
And did you see parallels between the story of Ake and P and the relations between, like, China and Britain?
Yeah, definitely. As I was looking into it, when when it was written and trying to get a sense of the time, it seemed to arise pretty organically out of that. The that during the Opium Wars, where Britain had nothing that China wanted to trade, so instead they just bombed Canton and then forced them to buy their opium from India and got the country hooked on opium, that it seemed to go along with ideas of parasitism, foreign bodies. And I stole an idea from an old X-Files episode where there was a parasitic twin that could detach and and used the parasitic twin to who could go off and wander around the city. And the twins hate each other, but also can't be apart from each other.
Do you? I get the sense in reading it that Ake sees himself as better than P, and that P, I don't know if there's like a compensation or something, but resents the fact that he's the parasite of the relationship.
Yeah, definitely. That P wants to be independent, but can't be. And Ake is definitely more the apologist, who's more willing to go along with the examinations of their body, and P wants nothing to do with it.
I was wondering, actually, if you had ever read Moto Hagio's Half God.
No, I haven't.
It's about conjoined twins, and they have to be separated for one of them, for them to live.
Okay.
It reminds me of a lot of what you were saying, and the idea of half God, them being half God and half human, and one of them is beautiful, and the other one looks like a pickle. And
well, that sounds fantastic.
Resentment between the two. And
sure.
Speaking of being God and human, do you want to read your next excerpt?
Sure.
Oh, the one that's the eight-legged.
Oh, sure, sure.
Yeah.
Yes, okay. Yeah, I would be happy to.
You're like, what kind of segue is that?
Okay, this one's called I Never Saw a Goddess Go, and starts with a detail from the London Daily Mail. In the village of Bihar, India, a girl born with four arms and four legs is thought to be the reincarnation of the Hindu goddess. And the poem is spoken by the girl's mother. From the ocean of my womb, the goddess Lakshmi herself unfurled her multiplicity of limbs for my lotus body. A girl is rarely cause to celebrate, but the village worshipped her, showered us upon our straw-tick palette with jasmine, saffron, every flower from the fields. But embodiments of gods are fraught. She hauled herself about, impediment of extra arms and legs that wield no fortune. Infected, she fevered to contain the sacred. Medics expected death, advised we sever the superlatives. But in which did Vedic divinity reside? The scans were silent, showed no glowing aura. I deferred to learned men's certainty, the weight at war. So, at age two, the deity divided, requiring multiple teams to execute the surgery. So many arms wheeling. And after, on the bed, my daughter, and an amputated form laid out, beatitude fled. A swift recovery, no sign of sepsis. 1 month in hospital, then home. No vengeance, none divine, though drought makes our neighbors hurl curses, blame us for luck gone, dried up. Make your own fortune, girl.
That was Heidi Sirwick reading from her collection, Conjoining. Heidi, you have some readings coming up. You want to talk about them?
Yeah, sure. On this Thursday, I'll be reading at Majors and Quinn at 7 o'clock. And then in a couple of weeks, on Sunday, April 15th, I'll be reading at Common Good Books.
Tax day.
I guess, yeah, although it's Sunday, so you still technically have one more day of reprieve.
Good to know.
Yeah, and I'll be reading with Elizabeth O'Brien, and both of those readings are free and open to the public.
Okay, great. So you just had a lyric essay collection get selected for publication and win a prize.
Yeah.
What? Tell us about that.
So after my son was born, I had mostly written 12 to 25 line short lyric poems. And after he was born, I started writing longer poems, and they got longer and longer and 4 pages. And then I was writing lyric essays and then essays and just kept going. And the lyric essay collection covers topics like perfume and the back and oil boom in Western North Dakota and canning tomatoes and mushrooms and an online outrage started at when I was still working at the University of North Dakota. And all of these I managed to bring together under the umbrella of the brilliant title Fluid States, which managed to encompass all of that and make it sound like I actually knew what I was doing when I was putting them together into a collection.
That's some good unity right there. So you were the senior poetry editor at Poetry City USA. Do you want to talk about what
you did? Yeah, Matt Mauch, who's the editor there, asked me if I would come on as one of the senior poetry editors. And it's a fantastic magazine to work with, and I'm really excited to be part of that, where the community college students at Normandale and elsewhere work on the magazine, and then the senior poetry editors oversee a group of the students in order to help them with who to invite to submit to the magazine, to write their essays on poetry, and to just mentor them, since community college students sometimes don't have as many resources as the larger university. So it's really exciting to get to work with the students that I've been paired with and to work on the magazine, and I'm really excited to be part of that.
Yeah, that's great. I went to the launch, and you and I had that I know I've seen you somewhere moment.
Right.
And we realized we knew each other from our work from MPWW. You want to talk about your work with MPWW?
Sure. Right after I moved to Minneapolis, I got invited to join a writing group that were all people who wanted to work on nonfiction, but were coming at it from different genres, from fiction or from poetry. And Jennifer Bowen Hicks, who started Minnesota Prison Writing Workshop, was part of that group. And after we'd been writing together for about almost a year, she started saying, "Hey, I think you'd be really good at this. If you miss teaching, you should come and teach for Minnesota Prison Writing Workshop." So I started off as a mentor with them and have been mentoring inmates one-on-one writing. And then we'll be, starting next month, we'll be working with a collective of women writers at the Shakopee Women's Prison.
That's amazing. I'm sure the more you spend time with that organization, just the more you learn.
It's fantastic. It's very moving. I'm so excited to be able to work with them.
Yeah, it's one of the greatest things, I think, here in the Twin Cities. We're close to out of time, but do you want to read one last poem?
Sure, I'd love to. This is from a sequence about man-made monstrous births and deformities. And this first part, a child of God, much like yourself, a mutagenic fantasia. The first part, which is the only part I'll read, is about Chernobyl. Wormwood, Gaul. He snatched a fire and cocked it. "Bang," he said. First, the face vibrates with stinging pins that pierce the skull with white light. Stippling against snow, he sparked. A metallic taste of iron sucked, sickening the tongue. Gag, coughing, and vomiting is inside Stellaquess, atomic bonds unlocking arms, the way a cold front melts or a cold war melts down, Soviet states of matter breaking up. He flailed fault line and burned absolute in his innards like saints. Children play in Ukrainian rain that turns black and oily. A gentle murder. Each child a lit lantern to be blown out. A toddler whose torso blooms into a tumor. Other self fused in a collision. Abandoned boy, spraddle-legged and ragged, slithering on a floor mat and lapping oatmeal like a whining pack animal. Laborious gargoyle unlearned. A girl, radiant in the frail sheathing of her throat. Unpinned ribbon of tongues. Odd steel of grace tonged to the fire's temper, until the doctors cut out her thyroid, glowing Chernobyl necklace. Winter, outraged, cauterized them young. The elderly return, following the trails of mushrooms shining in the forest, find their way back by the lights of their own throats. In the Russia under Russia, it is daylight all the time. They prefer to die on familiar, contaminated soil than in the anonymity of cities. Around them, the forest thrives, crackling, alive. The world's background noise increased threefold, its jaw a galvanized fist chattering. Static hum, hidden in the milk like spilt glitter. They say the lost come back as boars, as luminous deer, as songs in their scarred throats, frayed breath a vicious hissing. In the zone's irradiated radius, the concrete sarcophagus emits visitors minutes at a time.
That was Heidi Sirwick reading from her collection, Conjoining. We're all out of time. Thanks so much, Heidi.
Thanks for having me.
And now this.
One night, 18 strings, three award-winning guitarists. Monday, April 14th, the Dakota brings you the great guitars featuring Borelli LeGren, Martin Taylor, and Ulf Wakenis. Borelli LeGren, the undisputed king of jazz guitar, Martin Taylor, whose accolades stretch from Pat Metheny to Jeff Beck, and Ulf Wakenis, formerly with the Oscar Peterson Quartet. All three on stage for one night only, solo, duet, and trio performance of Jazz Magic. Tickets for the great guitars can be found at the Dakota website. Visit dakotacooks.com for more details.
You are listening to North Star Stories, Voices from Where We Live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
Today, our monthly conversation with WTIP's news director, as well as a play at St. Paul's History Theater about the role Japanese Americans played during World War II, and how radon is affecting Minnesota's schools. I'm Gracie J. Minnesotans have the chance to learn about the role Japanese Americans played during World War II. The play, The Secret Warriors, is on stage at St. Paul's History Theater now through April 19th. The play is inspired by the stories of two Japanese Americans who served as translators and interrogators for the U.S. Armed Forces. They served as the eyes and ears of General MacArthur and helped to save the lives of countless Allied soldiers. It's also said their work helped shorten the war. Ticket information for The Secret Warriors is online at historytheater.com. Coming up in this month's conversation with WTIP News Director Callie Hawkins, the Schrader Township Board meetings and a project aimed at increasing density for residential development.
Every 10 years, the community in Cook County gathers for a series of meetings and discussions to update its land use plan. This meeting focuses on opportunities for residential development, potential rezoning, and economic growth. WTIP News Director Callie Hawkins explains.
We have three townships in our county. We have Lutzen, Tofte, and Schroeder.
This month's conversations with WTIP, we discuss their coverage of these townships' meetings and the key issues being addressed.
This week, in one of our top stories was checking in with the Schroeder Township. It's kind of on the west end of Cook County, and had a chance to sit down with the Schroeder Township Board Chair, Bruce Martinson, and then also with our Cook County Planning and Zoning Administrator, Neva Maxwell.
Kelly explains that three community meetings have already taken place over the past few months, with a fourth meeting now in the works.
So one of the items that they're looking at is potentially decreasing the minimum acre lot size or parcel size there in targeted specific areas to allow for some of that residential density. Along the Lake Superior shoreline and the Highway 61 corridor at this moment in time, they're looking at maybe changing a little bit more targeted inland areas to allow for some density on specific roads, so one of those being Sugarloaf Road.
Another critical component of the land use update is broadband access, an essential service for the present and future of every community.
The Arrowhead Cooperative, kind of our local internet and electric provider here in Cook County, has been working out throughout the past few years, actually, of installing electric and broadband services along rural areas of Cook County. That kind of sits underneath the Rural Digital Opportunity Fund, and Arrowhead Cooperative was awarded funding from that.
The Rural Digital Opportunity Fund, established by the Federal Communications Commission in January 2020, aims to expand broadband access in rural America as part of the effort to bridge the digital divide.
Which is kind of a big deal in our neck of the woods, because a lot of the area we don't have that.
Another key discussion point is the potential expansion of about 170 acres near a decommissioned coal power plant, which could be repurposed for residential or commercial development.
Taconite Harbor. It's a coal-fired power plant that has been in operation for many years. It was shut down and then started the decommissioning process back in 2023. And there are conversations ongoing with the landowner, Minnesota Power, right now to potentially transition that site.
The land use planning process is still ongoing, with several months remaining before completion. To hear the full interview and more WTIP news, visit WTIP.org. For North Star Stories, I'm Victor Palomino.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Health officials are expressing concern about radon in Minnesota's schools. The odorless and colorless gas is linked to more than 21,000 deaths each year in the U.S. Radon seeps into buildings through cracks and openings in the foundation. A study by the Minnesota Department of Health found that only 39% of Minnesota's public schools tested for radon. The study also found that schools outside of the metro are less likely to test for the gas. The health department is offering reduced-cost testing kits to make it easier for schools to test for radon.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
Faces now, little darling.